Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth, straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden, and I'm working in...
An Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage, as parents, for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
Well, happy Labor Day. Obviously, it's not Chuck and Julie. They decided to take the day off. This is Mark Poff filling in for them, and I really appreciate them letting me fill in today. And John St. Augustine will be right here in a minute. If anybody's on and they'd like to call in, remember the number is 888-627-6008. Feel free to call in. I'll try to catch that, or you can send a chat message, and hopefully I'll be able to spot that and answer your questions if you have any. But today's podcast is going to be two parts. The first part, I'm actually going to talk a little bit about jury trials. I kind of gave a little bit of a teaser last Friday when I talked about being on a jury, and someone actually sent an email asking, you know, hey, could Mark clarify what he's talking about educating people on a jury? And so I'm going to try to do that in the first 10, 15 minutes. Then we're going to bring John on, and we're going to talk about some cases, a couple cases, and about technology and stuff, about when investigators with law enforcement don't do a thorough job. And especially when we're talking about technology, and then, you know, John and I are brought in on these cases, and we try to help out to straighten out some of this evidentiary issues. But sometimes law enforcement, you know, if they don't collect all the evidence at the beginning, they can actually kind of horse tie us up where we can't get some information because you could only obtain it at the time. We'll talk about that. So at first, I just kind of wanted to talk about jury trials a little bit. And about being on a jury. It was kind of interesting for me, being in law enforcement, being a detective for about 10 years with the El Paso County Sheriff's Office. You know, part of your job as being a detective is testifying in court. And this is really kind of, you know, going into the end zone. The trial is the finish or the end of the entire investigation. You do your investigation, then you hand it off to the district attorney's office. You help them. Then it may or may not go to trial. But when it does go to trial, then a lot of times you're expected to come in and testify in front of a jury about what you found, what your part of that investigation was. And so I was used to doing that. I did it a few times as a detective. And there's a lot of techniques and things that you know, that they talk to you about. And actually law enforcement gives you training about how to testify on the stand. You know, make sure that you look at the jury. If it's a hearing, you address the court or the judge and answer your questions to them. It's a little bit strange because an attorney asks you a question and then you want to turn to the jury to answer the question so you can explain your answer to the jury. And, you know, I have to tell you, at first, I was a little nervous doing this. Then it kind of switches over to being anxious about testifying. But you always want to make sure that you do a good job. You always want to make sure you tell the truth. You don't want to, you know, make any statements on the stand that's not true. And that's very important to me as an expert witness now that I'm working for defense and for prosecution as an expert. My testimony has to always be about the facts. You know, here's what I found. I examined this digital evidence, or I looked at these called detail records, cell phone records, and this is what I found. So I'm just basically reporting the facts. But one of the things that I found interesting was shortly after retiring from law enforcement, I was subpoenaed to be on a jury. And I thought, well, this is going to be a short trip. I'm going to go down to the courthouse. I'm going to tell them, hey, you know, I just retired from law enforcement like 3-4 months ago. You know, you need to boot me off of this. And they're like, you need to go up to the courtroom. So I went up there and I sat down with everybody else in the courtroom. And, you know, then they started asking questions. And this is the thing that I wanted to address today and give more clarity to kind of what I've been joking about or discussing with Chuck and Julie about being on a jury is there's no training. There's really no explanation. So some individuals, when they're subpoenaed to be on a jury, they get quite nervous because it's around expectations. It's around, you know, I don't know. It's the unknown. I've never been on a jury before. Now, if you've been on a jury two or three or four times, it becomes pretty routine. After that, you kind of figure things out and you know, everything's okay. But that first one or two times that you're on a jury, the judge tries to explain things, but you're still, there's a lot of this unsurety about being on a jury. So the first part is they bring you all up to the courtroom and they need to seat a jury. Who's going to be our 12 individuals? Well, first off, now that's going to depend whether it's a misdemeanor or a felony, civil, things like that. But let's just say in a standard felony criminal case, they need to have 12 jurors on that jury. Now, they're going to seat probably 13 or 14. They're going to have one or two alternates. And they're not going to tell you who that alternate, who the alternates are. So when you get sat on a jury, you're not going to know whether you're actually a regular juror or if you're one of the alternates. They're not going to tell you. Well, the first part, before you ever get on the jury, there may be 30 or 40 people in this room and you're thinking, wow, you know, they're going to whittle us down to 14. How are they going to do that? It's a process called voir dire. And this is a process that I've been part of as an expert. I've helped some attorneys through voir dire, which is basically Latin for to speak the truth. And so they're going to ask questions. And each attorney, whether it's the prosecutor or the defense attorney, they're going to ask specific questions to try to figure out if you're going to be to their advantage or, more importantly, not to the advantage of the other side. So they may ask very specific questions. And this is where it gets into where I said people are not really trained or understand, you know, about being on a jury. So we've all heard this phrase, innocent until proven guilty. And that's how America works. And the jury system is the best in the world. The innocent until proven guilty is the best process. But here's, you know, a question that was asked when I was sitting there, when I was sat on a jury, the defense attorney asked one of the individuals, if you had to vote right now on my client's guilt or innocence, what would you vote? And that individual sat there for a while and then they responded, well, I don't know. I don't have any information. And then the defense attorney asked, well, does anybody else have an answer to that question? Well, I rose my hand and I said, you know, I do have an answer. And she said, well, what is your answer? I said, I would vote not guilty because in America, you're innocent until proven guilty. So if there's no facts at this point, we would be obligated to vote not guilty. Well, then everybody was like, yeah, yeah, what he said, you know, because then they get it. So the thing is, once you've been on a jury once or twice, you kind of get it and you understand kind of how the process works. So then you're sat on a jury, you know, the trial starts. Another thing that I don't think a lot of people understand, or some people, is this whole phrase, we understand when the police need what's called probable cause to arrest. To convict someone of a crime at a trial, they talk about this beyond a reasonable doubt. Well, what's the definition of beyond a reasonable doubt? You know, is that given to us? Is that explained to us? You know, they tell us, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt. If you can do that, then you should be guilty. If it's not beyond a reasonable doubt, then you should vote not guilty. Well, what's the definition? And I actually heard a judge one time, I was sitting in a courtroom a few years back, and he said, let me explain to you what beyond a reasonable doubt is. It's basically what a reasonable person, what would cause a reasonable person to hesitate in making a major decision. He goes, that's a reasonable doubt. And his example was, you know, when you buy a house, you'll go do a walkthrough like a day or two before closing to make sure that the house is still in good order before you close a day or two later. So if you go into your house, this new house that you're getting ready to sign away this large, you know, mortgage for it, if you go in there and you see that maybe a window's cracked, that's probably not enough for you to say, you know what, I'm out. You know, a window's cracked, I'm out. You're probably not going to do that. You're going to say, you know what, just reference that window. And if you guys could fix it after closing, that would be great. And if it doesn't get fixed, it's really not a big deal. We can fix it. So it wouldn't cause you to hesitate. So that would not be beyond a reasonable doubt, or it would be beyond a reasonable doubt, and you'd still buy the house. But if you were to go to this home a day before closing and you go down in the basement and there's a foot of water at the bottom of the basement, you're probably not going to close on that house. So that would not be beyond a reasonable doubt. You would vote not guilty. You would not buy that house. I think that's probably the best explanation for beyond a reasonable doubt. So these are the things that I'm talking about. When people get on juries, I don't want to say they're not educated, but there could be confusions, and certain things I think should be laid out to the jurist. Definitely definitions for intent about each crime and stuff, and those are provided to you in written definitions. So another thing that happens in a jury trial is they tell you that after you hear all the evidence and you're done, you're going to go into deliberation. The first thing you're going to do is you're going to pick a foreperson. Well, they don't really explain to you how to pick the foreperson or what makes a good foreperson. They just tell you when you go back into the jury room, first thing you need to do is select a foreperson from one of you and then start deliberating. Well, I would tell you who you pick as a foreperson is actually fairly important. There's some skill sets that are involved in being a good foreperson. And typically, the person who really wants to be the foreperson is probably not the person you want to be the foreperson. So let's say this trial goes a couple of days. You've had an opportunity to socialize, and you should seek those opportunities with the other jurors when you go back to the jury room during the trial. They tell you that you can talk to each other, but just not about the trial. That doesn't mean you can't kind of get a sense for people. And we all know from experience, we know who are the individuals that suck all the air out of the room. The arrogant people that, you know, they always want to be in charge. They want to tell everybody what to do and things like that is not a good foreperson. And my statement would be, why can't you ask questions? So when you go back to the jury room and they say, first thing, pick a foreperson. Why don't you say, well, I'd like to know who's interested in being a foreperson. Let's say there's two or three people. Say, okay, I want to ask one question, you know, of each one of them to help me determine who would be the best foreperson. No reason why you can't do that. But the process, again, is not explained to everyone. And some people aren't willing to say, hey, let's do this. Let's do this. Some people aren't, you know, they're not outspoken and going to do this. Some people are leaders and some are followers. It's just the way that it is. A-type personalities and things like that. But it's important to get a foreperson that makes sure that every voice is heard. I mean, to me, that's just critical in a foreperson, is that they're heard and they're valued and the process is followed without intimidation by anyone. So you need a foreperson that is going to ensure that that happens. So depending on their answers, you could ask the question, what's important? What do you think is important to, you know, of being a foreperson? Because I think it's important that you get the right foreperson, because all 12 need to make sure. And the one trial that I was on, I was the foreperson. And I told them that, you know, I don't care if it's me or someone else who's the foreperson, doesn't matter to me. I just want to make sure that every voice is heard and valued and that we follow the process and nobody bullies anybody or anything like that. And they're all like, we want you. Because that's what's important in a foreperson, is to make sure that all opinions and voices are valued. So kind of going back during the trial, I kind of skipped ahead, but going back, I'm not sure that everybody understands, you know, as a jury, each individual gets to ask questions. That's one of the things that makes Colorado kind of unique, is that jurists or a person on a jury, at the end of someone testifying, after the defense and the prosecution have both had their questions answered by a witness, you can actually write down a question. The judge will read it. And if it's approved, the judge will ask that witness that question. That is a very valuable tool that can be used by people on a jury. So take that opportunity to ask questions. And also another thing that's important is understand that both sides want to win. It's kind of an adversarial process. So they're going to ask questions of that witness that help their side of the case. Understand, when a prosecutor brings in their witness, it's going to probably tend to show this person's guilty. When a defense attorney cross-examines, that's going to be to show that they're not guilty or try to muddy or gray the water. But it's important as a jurist to kind of see through the BS, kind of see through the emotion and stick to the facts. One thing that I think that anybody on a jury should do at the end of each witness. I encourage taking notes, brief notes, so you can remember, especially if it's going to be a long trial. You may forget those people who testified 3-4 days ago. But at the end, ask one question. What did the testimony from that person do to enhance the case or to make a point? Or because a lot of times they'll put people on the stand that really have nothing to do with the facts of the case. It's all about emotion. They're trying to get you to either hate the person or love the person. So understand it's an adversarial process. So that's what I'm talking about from the standpoint of, you know, kind of understanding the process so you can feel comfortable that, you know, sitting on a jury. And you should love sitting on a jury. That's something that you should want to do. You should want to sit on a jury, but you want to feel comfortable about it. And the last thing to kind of wrap this up is, as an individual jurist, you need to be able to say, you know what, I'm not satisfied that of their guilt. Even if the vote is 11 to 1, you need to say, I don't care that it's 11 to 1. I'm not sure. And here's the things that I have questions about. Let's continue talking and let's work to the end of this. I've actually seen jury trials where one jurist has actually kind of held the line, even to a hung jury, you know, because it's like, look, it didn't meet beyond a reasonable doubt for me. I get that it does for you. In the one trial that I told you that I was on as a jurist, when we went around the room and I said at first, let's just go around the room. If everybody feels comfortable, we can do it on paper. Or if everybody feels comfortable, you know, just say whether you think the person's guilty or innocent and why. And let's go around the room if you feel comfortable. If not, we can write it down. There's one like, hey, we feel comfortable. So we did. And we got around to one. And she said, I can't even remember if she said guilty or innocent. But she said, but hey, if everybody else thinks it's one way or the other, I'll go with everybody else. And I kind of thought to myself, yeah, I really don't think that's really how the jury system is intended to work. You need to feel comfortable. I think it was a little bit of a cop-out to say, hey, I went with everybody else, you know, so I feel comfortable. But I would like to see all 12. And we did it in that trial. We took a few hours. We discussed it until all 12 people said, I feel comfortable beyond a reasonable doubt on our decision. And there's usually multiple charges. And in our situation, some were not guilty. And I think on one, we found them guilty of one charge. And everybody agreed on that. And so we worked with the process. And I made sure as the foreperson that everybody was heard and valued and that everybody agreed at the end. And so that's important about being on a jury. And it can be a wonderful experience if done right. But unfortunately, we all know that one person, or, you know, we've run across these individuals that, you know, like I said, you know, they want to be the center of attention in every situation. That is not for a good four-person make. You need someone who needs to be compromise, a good negotiator, someone who makes sure that no one else is, you know, taking charge of everything and everybody's hurt. So I wanted to kind of lay that out so everybody kind of knew how I felt about being on a jury. I think, it's a wonderful experience. I look forward to doing it again. Especially from being from my side and then being on a jury, I think I'm pretty hard on all sides on, hey, you got to make your case, you know, because I've been down this many times before. So, and moving on, and at this point, if we could bring on John St. Augustine, and we're going to talk about a couple examples. John and I both were investigators. There's John. We can see him now. And just experience for some of those, if there's one or two on that haven't seen John before. I was a detective with the El Paso County Sheriff's Office for 10 years. I was in law enforcement for 17. John was also in law enforcement for 17 years. And he went up through the supervising ranks. He was an inspector, which means that he was the lead investigator. So he was in charge of all the detectives. That's usually what an inspector title is. And then ultimately, he was the commander of investigations. And we worked together for many years, investigating many homicides, many major cases. And then we both decided that we were going to retire and we wanted to do our own little business. And we both worked together on a lot of projects together. And we've actually had a great time. We've been doing this for about 6-7 years now, working together on numerous projects, mainly for defense attorneys. But, you know, I've worked for prosecution as well. They've retained me. And one of the things that we've seen is when I was a detective, and I know when John was an investigator with us, or, you know, when we worked together, we always worked on following the facts, follow the evidence of the case, you know, and follow that through to get to the end result. You know, if you're going to arrest someone, you're denying them their freedom, you better make sure you're right. And so we always tried to do a very thorough investigation. And we've seen from this side, working for defense on some cases, where we would say that the investigation was less than stellar and how they handled that. So the first case, John, if you don't mind kind of walking us through it, it's what we refer to as the Snapchat Instagram case, and walk through that, and then we'll explain some of the things that we did to help on this case.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me on again, Mark. It's Labor Day, so we still have another, 30-some minutes to talk before I should be talking. So thanks. You know, you wanted to talk about some cases. You know, the case that you're referring to is a case that, you know, you and I both worked for the client. But just to give the audience kind of a background, so a guy was charged with stalking. This is a boyfriend.
And domestic violence.
Right, domestic violence, right? Stalking. Boyfriend's charged with stalking his ex-girlfriend. And to give the audience kind of a background on this relationship, obviously it was a relationship that was very heated. There was obviously, you know, they were no longer in this intimate relationship. And as a result of that, there's always one party, right, that tends to not take it so well. And so in this particular case, a gal had basically reported to Denver Police Department, that her boyfriend had been stalking her in violation of a restraining order that she had earlier, that she had actually established earlier in that particular year. And so what she did was, you know, she calls law enforcement over. She says, hey, my boyfriend's truck was just outside of my house. It's in violation of this restraining order. Look, let me show you my phone. And so she literally takes out her phone and she says, look at the messages that he's sending me. And so what law enforcement and what happens is two Denver police officers arrive on scene. And they look at her phone, and what they see is this communication between her and him, her meaning the victim, him meaning her boyfriend, her ex-boyfriend, communicating on Snapchat and Instagram. And so immediately, because the officers saw this on the phone, they make the arrest. And so what we know, right, is that stalking is a felonious charge, and at that point, you know, the alleged suspect in this particular case says, you know, look, he tells his attorney, look, I didn't violate any restraining order. I never went to her house. I don't know what she's talking about. And one of these, you know, cases like this, Mark, you know, as you know, we see this all the time. I mean, we saw it in law enforcement pretty much on a daily basis, right? I mean, there's always, you know, altercations between, you know, two people who claim to love one another or in some kind of intimate relationship. And so attorney hires us to look at this, you know, me to look into more of the investigative aspects of the case. And, you know, of course you want to sit down with the client and say, okay, you know, obviously police saw this on your phone. How could this have happened? And he says, I don't know how it happened, but I'm telling you, I've never communicated with her on Instagram or Snapchat since there was a restraining order in place, which really piqued my interest because he was extremely adamant about it. He's like, you can pretty much call me anything in the book, but I'm telling you, I did not commit a crime. I did not, you know, violate this restraining order. And so I looked at the client and I said, you know, these are the hardest cases to defend because, you know, you have an alleged suspect who obviously is extremely adamant that they did not commit a crime. So how do you prove that this crime was not committed? So for starters, what, you know, in looking at the investigation, it reported that in the actual Denver police reports, there was some claims by the alleged victim that her boyfriend's vehicle was in the front yard. And that's what prompted her to call 911. Well, when I talked to the client about it, I said, you know, she's claiming that your car was in front of her house. And he says, wait a second. I have never been in front of her house since this restraining order. I said, okay, well, how do we prove this? So, you know, initially my thought was maybe we can get his phone, take a look at some of the call detail records, maybe see if he's, you know, somewhere specifically, right? Maybe look at some geolocations, maybe find out if he's somewhere else in town at the time that she's claiming that he's stalking her. Well, what happens is he goes, what was that date again? And I said, well, it was, you know, on this particular date that she's reporting. He goes, wait a second. He goes, John, my car was stolen and I had not received my car back in that time frame. I said, wait, time out. You're saying your car was stolen, your truck was stolen during this time that she's alleging that you stalked her? And he goes, absolutely. I said, okay, well, you know, where's the police report? You know, did you initiate a police report to tell him that your truck had been stolen? And he says, yes. In fact, you know what? Let me go look for it. Sure enough, his truck was stolen at the time that she's reporting that he's stalking her. But, you know, that's not good enough, right? I mean, even though the truck is reported stolen, could there be another chance that, you know, that maybe he's still there? We still got to prove something, right? And it's not just the fact that his car was stolen or his truck was stolen. So I said, you know what? Let's look at your Snapchat and Instagram accounts. He goes, well, I haven't accessed them. I said, what do you mean you haven't accessed them? He goes, I haven't looked at any of my Instagram or Snapchat information in quite some time. I said, even during the time of this reported, you know, stalking charge. And he goes, no, I have not communicated with her. I'm telling you, I have not talked to her. So lo and behold, what happens is I start to look at the Instagram and Snapchat records and come to find out she had logged in to both his Instagram and Snapchat accounts. You know, they had an intimate relationship. She knew about his Instagram and Snapchat login and password. And what does she do? She begins to send messages on Snapchat as if he was sending it. And, you know, as we know, right, the phone, just by the fact that law enforcement only looked at the specific messages, that's not sufficient, right? We actually need to do more digital forensics on the phone. And come to find out, there were no digital forensics done on the phone. All they did was they looked at her phone, assumed that he was communicating with her, and that was their probable cause for the arrest. Long story short, right, what happens is the investigation reveals that she, in fact, logged in on his accounts, logged in to make it look like he was communicating with her, and then set him up to where she then called law enforcement, said his truck was in the front. We were able to show that the truck had been stolen, and we were able to show that the Snapchat accounts and the Instagram accounts, in fact, were not accessed by anybody but her at the time of this alleged stalking incident. So that's kind of a long-winded deal, Mark. I kind of went about 10 minutes into the background, but the client actually was found. They ended up dropping the charges after the attorney presented these facts to the prosecutor. But, you know, it's one of those situations where, you know, very quickly and very easily somebody's, you know, not civil rights or constitutional rights can be violated just based on, you know, an allegation. And we see this, unfortunately, so many times. Not that there's not obviously stalking and domestic violence cases that go on, but I will tell you that we're starting to see more and more of, you know, alleged victims who are not happy that they're no longer together in the relationship, using digital evidence to make the appearance of them actually communicating, you know, in this case, the suspect communicating with her. What should have happened is that she should have been charged with false reporting. And what we find out is that in a lot of these, you know, situations, prosecutors just want to get rid of it, right? They just want to be done with it. They don't want to move any further into it unless, you know, it's something that happens to be, there's more historical data that they do this, you know, all the time. But in this particular case, this particular alleged victim was not charged with any kind of false reporting.
And some of the interesting points about that case, that was really more of John's case than mine. I actually did look at some call detail records, some phone records. And as it turns out, you know, he didn't live in Denver. He actually lived down here in El Paso County, but he was up in Denver that day that she said that. Now, if I remember right, she knew that he had to go to a meeting.
Correct.
You know, like every Saturday he went to this meeting or training. I think it was training. He's a, can't remember, a plumber, electrician or something. And so she knew that, you know, and the cell phone records back that up, that he went to this thing and came right back home. So there was no diversion off of the interstate towards where that residence was. But a couple of the key points is, and I hate to say this, you know, John and I aren't cheap. You know, it's an expensive process to bring us in to look at call detail records and to do all this other stuff. So if somebody doesn't have financial resources to be able to do this, they may not have been able to prove their innocence, which is kind of my issue, is they need to be able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he did this. But what they're calling is evidence, I call digital hearsay. That's kind of my big thing, is you show, like you said, you show someone your cell phone and say, see, and we're going to talk here in a few minutes about all kinds of stuff that you can manipulate on cell phones. That's not evidence. That's like hearsay. That's like somebody saying, hey, I saw or I heard him say this to her. You know, you need digital evidence, just like you need blood trace evidence. You need fingerprints, you know, all the stuff that we use is, you know, typically physical evidence. You also need to obtain digital evidence, and you need to do it in a legal fashion and in such a way that you don't compromise the evidence. What they could have done in this case is, one, they could have taken her cell phone and processed it. And another thing is they could have subpoenaed Snapchat and Instagram and gotten the IP addresses. Now, most people are familiar with what IP addresses are now because we live in this digital age. It basically points back to the location of the router that was used when the communication happened. It would have, if they'd obtained this information, they would have seen that it pointed back to her phone, not to his phone, but yet they didn't get this evidence. And because they didn't get it right away, you know, it compromises our ability to provide a defense and challenge the veracity of the evidence being used against our client. So those are the things that, because, and I don't want to say they did a lazy job, it's just that they don't understand that when it comes to digital evidence, you have to still get what's referred to as best evidence, which is actual IP addresses and all this other stuff, because things can be manipulated. I can show you stuff on your cell phone that's just not true. You know, that's why you have to process the cell phone. That's why you have to get phone records and you have to do all this stuff methodically. But here's, from law enforcement standpoint, do they really want to have to go back to the office over what they consider to be a silly little DV stalking case, write a couple warrants, and have to get this information to prove who's, you know, who's telling the truth? Well, my statement would be, yeah, you do. It's that important, because you're going to ruin this guy's life. And then we helped the process. You know, now, fortunately, with this district attorney's office, as soon as we came in and said, look, you know, here's all the evidence that we have, they dropped the charges. So that was good for them, you know, that they, when they look at the truth, because the district attorney's office, all they should be interested in is the truth. That's it. And once they're shown that the truth is not what they thought, they should act upon that. Not all district attorneys are willing to do that.
You know, Mark, if I can just interrupt for just a moment here, you know, the sad part of these types of situations is that when a false claim like this is made on somebody, right, that individual who's now a suspect with a felony charge against him is pretty much ruined. I mean, you know, whatever he's doing, you know, if he's a teacher, if he's a doctor, if he's a lawyer, if he's trading stocks on the, you know, on the stock market, you know, if he has any kind of specialized licenses, what I will tell you is that at the point that he has felony charges, more than likely he's going to lose his ability to work. But here's the problem with it. He actually has to go out and hire people, right, to prove his innocence. And instead of, you know, and you know, we both have been in law enforcement for an extended period of time, but instead of law enforcement taking their time and going through and making sure that these allegations have some meat behind it, some evidence behind it, they went and made the arrest right away. And some of the things they could have done rather easily was, number one, see if his truck, if there was a truck registered to this guy's name, right? I mean, that's like one of the first things you do. Oh, he owns a truck. What's his name? Oh, his name's this, John Doe. Okay. Well, yeah, what? You know what? He does have a truck. Oh, but wait, his truck was reported stolen. Yeah. Now you have to kind of question like, okay, is this alleged victim really telling us the truth? So before I go out and arrest this guy for stalking, I want to probably make sure that that's in fact what's going on. But, you know, unfortunately, what happens is probable cause is such a low threshold that law enforcement, you know, doesn't go through all the steps to ensure that this individual should be arrested for those charges.
Right.
And they see this text and immediately, you know, they hear that the truck is there. And, you know, probably in 7 out of 10 situations, that's probably accurate. But do you want to be wrong 3 of those 10 times? And I would tell you, we cannot afford in law enforcement to be wrong and violate people's rights, their constitutional rights, to where now he has to spend a lot of money to get experts to prove that he's innocent, or and an attorney to be his mouthpiece to prove his innocence as well, which is what leads us to a lot of the situations that we see right now where people will take a plea, right? Because they don't have right. the ability, the resources to fight that particular fight.
Yeah. One of the things, like you said, probable cause. A lot of people don't understand where probable cause is. Like you said, it's a low bar. Beyond a reasonable doubt's way up here. Probable cause is down here. One of the things that I always teach at the college in the post academy that I teach at is just because I always ask it like this first. So you guys are all wanting to become cops. So tell me this, if you're investigating something and you have established probable cause, should you make an arrest right away? And of course they're all like, yeah, you have probable cause, make an arrest. And I said, well, let me ask you another question. Can you lose probable cause? So once you achieve probable cause, could you do more investigating and lose probable cause? And they're like, well, yeah, I guess that's true too. Well, then isn't it important to not just stop? Like, I'm going to investigate until I receive probable cause or get to probable cause. Then I'm going to quit and make an arrest. That's not how it works. You need to complete a thorough examination or investigation. And then at the end of your investigation, if you have probable cause, make an arrest. And so I try to make that click with them that it's very important that you do a thorough investigation and not one that's just to achieve probable cause, which is, again, a very low bar.
Right. And, you know, to give you another example, we talked about this, Mark, and, you know, another case in a different jurisdiction here in Colorado, right? A burglary happens at a local business and one of their employees happens to be there at the business, right? He's working that particular evening. And anybody who's done investigations, right? When you're looking at an investigation, you have to look at a timeline. And so you have to ask yourself, who is the last person, right, in that particular business prior to this reported burglary, right? And this is what happened in this particular jurisdiction, is that there was a report of a burglary. Some police officers go by a business. They know that there's some broken glass and that somebody had entered this particular business and it looked like they had stolen some items from the business. So naturally, as part of that investigation, right, you're going to say, when was this business last open? Well, this particular business was a fast food business. And the person who was working there worked until roughly midnight. So naturally, right, law enforcement's going to call that individual, bring them in and go, hey, tell us, you know, did you lock the door? Did you set a code? Did you know, tell us a little bit about, you know, what happened this particular night and how you closed down the business. Are you sure you locked the door? Well, they go to this individual and they say, this individual says, look, I was gone. I dropped my manager off at his residence. And then I came, you know, I went home. And obviously law enforcement's a little skeptical. They're wondering, you know, as natural, right? They're going to be wondering what's going on. And so they asked him, hey, so you said you did all this. Do you mind if we take a look at your phone? Which, right, when you look at search and seizure, your Fourth Amendment, right? There's only two ways that you can search somebody's personal things, right? A phone can only be searched if law enforcement can either get a search warrant to search the phone, or if the individual who owns the phone actually gives consent, right? So in this particular case, The guy says, look, I can show you. He goes, I have, in fact, Google Maps and Timeline on my phone, and I can show you that I actually dropped the manager off, and then I went home. Well, he looks at the phone. He shows the police officer his geolocation, and it shows that he's at the business at the time that this supposed burglary occurred. So immediately, what do? They make an arrest based on them looking at data off of his phone. Well, you know, if you've done this work for any extended period of time, you know that just looking at somebody's phone is not good enough. And so here's another situation, right? Client calls attorney, tells attorney, look, I didn't burglarize anything. I dropped my manager off and I went home. That's all I did. And you know, of course, the attorney's a little skeptical. He's like, okay, I mean, is there any evidence that you can give that proves this? And he goes, I had my phone with me the whole time. But when I showed him it, it said that I was at the, you know, at this particular business. Well, lo and behold, take a look at the data, the actual data. And law enforcement didn't get a chance to look at all the raw data.
They didn't even try.
They just basically looked at what he showed. You know, they looked at his Google Maps and timeline, saw that he was there sometime around midnight and said, oh, you must have been here during the time of the burglary. So therefore, we're going to arrest you. But if they had looked further, right, if they had actually seized the phone, grabbed a search warrant to then obtain the records, they would have seen immediately that what this individual was telling them was in fact true. That he did take the manager home, and that after he took the manager home, he actually went home he left Woodland Park and went to Colorado Springs. Well, again, right? He has to hire an attorney. He has to hire experts. He hires us to look at this, and eventually the charges are dismissed.
And what was funny is that we actually pushed the district attorney to get the evidence. We actually said, go get a warrant. Go look at the time, you know, go get this information. We pushed them to do this. And then they went and got it. They looked at it and said, we don't see what the big deal is. Then we looked at it and said, wait a minute, you know. And so they actually came over to our office and we briefed them, actually put it up on the screen and said, here's our analysis of what we found. And it clearly shows he did go down and drop off his manager. You know, it's all right there, you know. And then after that, you know, then it was resolved favorably, you know, after that, which, you know, again, if they didn't have the finances to go through this, you know, it would have been a bad outcome for this individual. And my issue is district attorney's offices need, well, actually, I don't even want to say DA's offices. Law enforcement needs to understand technology, even from patrol and investigations, and they need to make sure that they do a thorough investigation, no matter how a trivial of a case they think it is. Oh, it's just a little burglary. Well, it's just a little burglary to you, but for this person, that could be a felony conviction, which means they can't get into the military or they can't get a good job. So it totally ruins their life and ability to make income for their family. But to law enforcement, it could be, well, that's just a little burglary case. And so they need to take the next steps and securing that digital evidence.
Right. And, you know, Mark, I mean, you know, I think what we're going to start to see is, you know, we're seeing across the country right now that, you know, people don't want to get into law enforcement. It's a very noble profession. But what we're doing right now is we're lowering our standards more and more because we don't have, you know, people wanting to go through a police academy. And what's going to happen is that because there's this lack of resources to actually go out and conduct follow-up investigation, what you're going to see is that more and more people are going to report things like this, and it becomes so overwhelming to the poor officer or the poor detective that their bosses want them to hurry up and resolve the case. And so they're like, you know what? He's there. I saw it on the phone. You know, the timeline shows that he was in the area of that particular business. I'm just going to go through and do a PC affidavit to arrest him for burglary instead of taking some time to actually make sure, right, by going out and getting a search warrant to look at these records and actually taking the phone, right? Because if somebody's innocent, what are they going to say? Look, I can show you on my phone. You know what? If you want to take my phone, as much as it's an inconvenience, rather than me getting arrested, take it, do whatever you got to do, and then give it back to me, right? But what happens is they think, they look at the snap, you know, they look at a photograph of it, and they think, well, you know what? That must be true. So we'll go ahead and move forward with the arrest. But if, you know, it's, I think what we're going to start to see more and more is that there's going to be these, this rush, right? And because of, like you said, a lack of an understanding of the technology, that lack of understanding and really not a time to understand it, they're going to be forced to have to go out and make these kind of split second decisions. And unfortunately, it tends to create problems for those who are innocent. For the person who did it, not a problem. I'm all on board. Right. When you do something, you know, you pay the time. You should be disciplined for whatever you do. But if you're that guy or that gal who did not commit the crime, but you're accused of it, right? There's an allegation that you did this. You know, there's nothing worse than being accused of doing something you never did. And unfortunately, we're starting to see a lot more of those types of cases, especially those cases involving technology.
Right. And I think here's the scenario is you have young people. I will say, when I say young people, I'm pretty old. So that's about anybody under 50, but people under 30.
Hey, easy. I'm old then too.
Individuals under 30 are very comfortable with technology. And they, you know, they text, they Snapchat, Instagram, all kinds of stuff. And so they understand how a lot of this technology works. They're comfortable with IP addresses, MAC addresses, and all kinds of stuff. And so what you do is you have a skill set of your clientele or the community to where they understand how they can manipulate the digital evidence to show, like you said, you know, I'm going to show you my phone and I'm going to let the cop look at my phone and it's going to show, you know, Johnny sending me a text message saying, I'm going to come over and kill you. And then you're like, well, we're going to go arrest Johnny. You know, instead, their first thing they need to say is, no, I need to look at your phone. It says Johnny here, but let's look at your contact list to see if Johnny actually equates to Johnny's cell phone, you know, first. And plus, even if it comes back as Johnny's cell phone, doesn't mean that Johnny didn't have his cell phone, things like that. So you have a lot of young people that definitely understand how to manipulate technology. And then typically law enforcement officers are not big into technology typically. And so they're uncomfortable. And so they need to understand that some of this stuff can be manipulated. Let me give you a good example. I could show you a phone call from any phone number I want. You can spoof caller IDs. And we know this is true. In fact, they're even talking about making it illegal to do that, but it's not illegal. And there's apps. If you go out and search, you know, I'm telling people how to do things. I shouldn't be doing this. But there's apps out there that you can actually make a phone call and you can make the caller ID look like something else. And we get it all the time. And you used to, on your phone, you see one that comes across and it says potential spam now a lot of times. And we've received calls, and this happens all the time. You know, I'll get a phone call every once in a while. And they'll say, hey, you just called me. And it's like, no, I didn't. No, I just got a phone call from your caller ID. And it's like, no, you didn't. It's because somebody spoofed my caller ID. So what they do is they try to use the same area code that you're from and the same prefix of where you're at to spoof their spam calls to people. And so we know that's possible. We know that we can do about anything we want with cell phones to make it appear like something, but you have to do your due diligence. You have to do forensics. You have to look at phone records. If I said that I called somebody or I received a call, guess what? If you go get the phone records, it's going to clearly show that. But if you just look at the guy's phone and it says, well, here, it says you got a phone call from Hunter Biden. So you obviously talked with Hunter Biden. Well, no, just because it says Hunter Biden doesn't mean that's actually who's on the other end. So there's all kinds of stuff you can do to manipulate technology, especially with the spoofing. So it encourages cops to do their homework.
I agree. You know, and Mark, I mean, you know, we just talked about two examples, but I mean, I could talk about all kinds of cases. I mean, there was just a case I did more recently where, you know, a gentleman at the Air Force Academy, top of his class, just a smart kid. He's alleged to have sent child pornography to a gal who had a crush on him. And law enforcement said, look, this is what he sent to me. But yet they never took his phone, and lo and behold, he had no pornography on his phone, but they never obtained his phone. And yet, what did that result in? It resulted in him not being able to graduate with his class because the allegation of sexual exploitation on a child, that's a felony. And, you know, the military is very strict about who they're going to allow to, you know, be a member of the, of, you know, of the military. And somebody who's involved in sexual exploitation, they'd rather take their chances and say, you know what, we're just going to distance ourselves from this individual. And what do they end up doing? Right. They end up getting rid of them. It happens to teachers all the time. Kids that are involved, you know, they it becomes not a teacher student relationship. It becomes a student who maybe has a crush on the teacher. And we've seen cases where teachers have had inappropriate relationships with students as well. But what we find is that it all probably surfaces around their ability to communicate via, you know, via their smartphone, whether it's Instagram, Snapchat, you know, name it, Facebook, it, you know, texting, name it, you know, they're able to do this. And, you know, basically they can, they, you know, anybody can really set up anybody to say, yeah, that message came from him or her, and here it is. And, you know, what does law enforcement do? They err on the side of caution. What's the side of caution? We're going to go arrest him because we have probable cause to make the arrest. But yet again, you know, what we need to do is take a couple steps back and make sure before we do these types of things to understand the technology and make sure that the technology is in fact showing that this is in fact what happened.
Right. Here, I want to address this question or the statement that was made, and then we're going to wrap this up.
Sure.
It's talking about a man down in Florida and that they used Google data, location data, to show that he was in the area of the crime scene, and they arrested him, and it appears he had nothing to do with this crime. Right. Understand, on your cell phone, there's geolocation. And you can turn on and off these locations for each app, whether it can obtain your location or not. If you're running an app that has absolutely no reason to know where you're at, turn off geolocation. There's absolutely no reason for that app to know where you're at. But if you're using like MapQuest or Google Maps, you obviously are going to turn on your location on your cell phone because that's how it uses it to tell you which way to drive and all kinds of stuff. Understand that Google captures all that data and they hold on to it. And if law enforcement gets a warrant, they can look at that data. Now, what they're talking about, we refer to it as a geofence. So let's say there's a crime that was actually committed at Coors Field. Let's just pick Coors Field. Now, that'd be a bad example because there's going to be a lot of people at Coors Field. But let's say it's after hours in the area of Coors Field. What law enforcement can do is they can notify Google, and Google won't tell them who. But they'll say, I want to know who was in this geofence right around Coors Field from 1 a.m. to 1:15. Was there anybody there who had their location services turned on using Google Maps or Google? They'll come back and say, yes, there was. If there was, let's say there was six people. Then they can come back and say, we want to know, you know, more specifics about where, we want to know where those six people were. And then they can do that. Then they can find out who they were. So understand that with technology, you have cell phone records, you have the downloading of cell phones, you have these geolocations. If they're wearing ankle bracelets, obviously, there's all kinds of technology now that is used to track your locations. So understand that, but they just need to make sure that that they do it properly and stuff. And again, from our standpoint, to wrap this up, John, thanks again for helping with this. I think it was awesome.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We're obviously both very pro law enforcement. I mean, we're both in law enforcement for 17 years, but we just want to make sure that they do a thorough job, a thorough investigation before they make arrests, and then be open to obtaining the digital evidence. So I hope everybody had a great Labor Day. I had a great Labor Day. After this, I'm going to go outside again and stuff. And Chuck and Julie will be back on Wednesday. Hope everybody has the great rest of their day. See everybody later.